Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Since the Senate confirmed Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg last fall, it has held a conservative supermajority, 6-3. Five of the six conservative justices were appointed by a president who lost the popular vote. So how did they rule on major cases this term? Well, the 6-3 party line vote to restrict voting has received a lot of attention. As NPR reports, at issue in the case were two Arizona laws. One banned the collection of absentee ballots by anyone other than a relative or caregiver, and the other throughout any ballots cast in the wrong precinct. And we'll talk about that case later in the show. In another 6-3 party line vote, the court sided with Americans for Prosperity, saying they do not have to reveal their donors to the California Attorney General. Americans for Prosperity was funded by David and Charles Koch and other organizations. The court also issued three corporate rulings that have received little attention. In his book, Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-year battle for a more unjust America. Today's guest, Adam Cohen, writes, "These are dire times on the court. The conservative majority has been on a campaign for the past 50 years to shift the law in ways that lift up businesses and wealthy individuals and push down the middle class and the poor, and it has had great success." Adam Cohen has a new piece in The Atlantic arguing that the longer Justice Stephen Breyer remains, the more likely a Republican president will choose his successor. Adam Cohen served as a member of the New York Times editorial board and a senior writer for Time magazine. Hi, Adam. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Oh, my pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to have you, Adam. Before we dive in and talk about specific cases, let's talk about the big picture here. You were on our show talking about your book, Supreme Inequality, and you write that if you look at the court over the last 50 years and the cases, there's really been a campaign to shift the law to favor businesses and the wealthy and to push down the middle class and the poor. Can you tell us, just kind of remind us of your overall argument?
Sure. And yes, 50 years is exactly the benchmark. So there was a time during the Warren Court, as it was known, when California Governor Earl Warren had become Chief Justice, when there was a progressive court that was really fighting for the downtrodden. It was expanding the rights of welfare recipients. It was expanding the rights of workers and unions. It was very skeptical of corporations. It was, you know, respectful of things like regulation. So that was the norm for quite a while. Then President Nixon is elected on a promise to turn the court to the right. And he does that. Nixon is elected. And in 1969, his first year in office, he starts a total overhaul of the court. He gets to appoint four justices in 3 years. By the time Nixon leaves office, he has created a right-wing court that unbelievably has been with us for 50 years. There have been variations, of course, on who's on the court and slight variations in the size of the conservative majority. But since Nixon appointed that court that he created, there's been a conservative chief justice who has always had at least a majority of five. And they've done the things you've described. They have ruled for corporations. They have been very eager to strike campaign finance regulations, which make it easier for rich people to dominate politics. They've ruled against unions, against workers. That's the court we've had for 50 years. And now, as you mentioned in the introduction, they're emboldened because they have a 6-3 majority. And we're starting to see this term, and I'm afraid we're going to see even more next term, just how, you know, dangerous that, you know, emboldened conservative majority can be.
Adam, I'm not sure if you're talking into a mic, but maybe if you can move back a little, some of what you're saying is a little muffled.
Sure. Yeah. Let me hold it further from my mouth. Sorry.
Okay. That's great. Thank you. Can you also, we've done a lot of shows about this, but I think we should again dive into this. In simplistic terms, if you want to say conservative, progressive, conservatives have done an incredible job of putting a major machine together with millions and millions of dollars to have people lined up, especially under Trump. It was almost like they gave him the list and said, these are the people you need to appoint. I mean, we're talking about the Federalist Society. In terms of progressives, they have not done that. They've been so slow to even care about the court, to talk about the court on a regular basis. I mean, you cannot compare the two. Can you go into that a bit?
Yes, it's a great point. And as you say, the conservatives have been much better at gaming the system of the court, and it's had a tremendous impact. So they've done that in a number of ways. One is, as you say, they've put together these lists, and they've really gotten the most right-wing justices you can imagine onto the court, right? People like, you know, Clarence Thomas, people like Samuel Alito, who are far, far on the right. Progressives haven't done that. Yeah, you know, in the times when there have been Democratic presidents who've made nominations, they've nominated much more centrist Democrats, folks like Elena Kagan and Justice Breyer, who, as you mentioned, I just wrote about. So that's one part of it. Another part is that they just, conservatives and Republicans have been so much better about holding on to seats and blocking Democrats from getting seats. So, you know, we've got the famous example of that Merrick Garland, right, who, you know, Merrick Garland was nominated by President Obama, should have been confirmed, but Mitch McConnell just said, we're not confirming, you know, any Democratic nominees right now. At the same time as they're doing that, the Republicans have done a great job of handing off their seats. So Anthony Kennedy steps down when he's actually in good health. But it was the last opportunity when he knew that a Republican president, Trump, would be able to appoint someone. And there was a Republican Senate for sure that would be able to confirm him. The piece you mentioned that I wrote in The Atlantic was calling attention to just what the Democrats are not doing, which is, you know, Justice Breyer could have done what Kennedy did. Breyer's 82. He's had a really distinguished time on the court. He could have stepped down. Biden would have been able to nominate a younger person, someone who would be confirmed because the Democrats control the Senate. And we could have had a lock on that seat for maybe decades. Breyer didn't do that. So in every way, the Republicans have just been gaming the court. And because there are only nine justices, if you can get one more justice, two more justices on the margins, that's how you build something like the 6-3, you know, majority they have today.
Right. Well, and one of your main arguments is we've heard people say there should be more justices on the court or there should be term limits. And you have argued, okay, that sounds great, but you're never going to get that done with today's makeup of the Senate. I mean, you said, I believe it was on Democracy Now!, you said you can't even get these Republicans to agree to a basic infrastructure bill, let alone term limits on the Supreme Court.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I'm all in favor of doing some structural reform to the court. I mean, the court was created a long time ago by the Constitution at a time, for one thing, when people didn't live very long. So the idea that they weren't really thinking about justices serving for, you know, like Amy Coney Barrett could serve for, you know, 40, 50 years. So they did not have that in mind. And also the original court wasn't nine justices. It started out with six. So there's nothing magical about the number nine. There's nothing magical about having people, you know, stay on the court for 40 years. So I think we should rethink all those things. But then just as you say, I don't like people holding that out and saying, well, Democrats don't need to worry about gaming one seat. They don't need to worry about getting Justice Breyer to step down because we'll get these much bigger reforms. Because as you say, there are huge obstacles to getting that. If we can barely get an infrastructure bill through that will help all 50 states, you don't know why there's not more support for it. How are we going to get a majority, not only a majority of the Senate, but, you know, a filibuster-proof majority to do any of this? How are we going to get, you know, the Democrats like Manchin, who are on the margins, to totally overhaul the court? We're not. So we need to play the game the Republicans are playing because this bigger stuff is just not going to happen anytime soon.
What are your thoughts about Justice Breyer? I mean, when you think about it, we are in July now, 2021, and this is such an important issue because, as you said, if a Republican wins in 2024 and he doesn't step down until then, we could have a 7-2 court.
Totally true. I mean, I should start by saying I really like Justice Breyer. In fact, he was my professor in law school. I had him for a year of administrative law. He's a very kind and decent person who's done a lot of great stuff on the court. So this is not in any way a knock on him. And I felt the same way about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who also did not step down. And now Amy Coney Barrett is in her seat. So it's not anything against Breyer. But yes, he's 82. And if he were to do the right thing and step down now, it would be, you know, taking one for the team and very important because we don't know, you know, if something were to happen to Patrick Leahy, say, tomorrow, there's a Republican governor in Vermont who would replace his seat. And suddenly Mitch McConnell would be able to block any, you know, Biden nominees. And it's quite likely the Republicans will pick up more senators in the midterms. So this could be the last chance for someone like Justice Breyer to do the right thing and hand off that seat to someone who, you know, could be 40 years younger than him. And it would be a great thing for the values that, you know, he believes in.
Today we are talking about the Supreme Court with Adam Cohen. He's the author of Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-year battle for a more unjust America. And you can find his piece at yourcallradio.org, Justice Breyer's Legacy Defining Decision. If you have any questions about the court, where we are right now with the 6-3 conservative supermajority, what cases stood out to you this term, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Has anything stood out for you with media coverage of the cases, Adam? Some people like David Sirota criticized the media, saying it was just way too simplistic. You know, for example, calling like Amy Coney Barrett congenial and the court wasn't as bad as some people expected. What are your thoughts overall about how the media cover the courts?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think there's a desire to sort of say now that we have a moderate court. So there's a lot of efforts to say that Roberts is really playing a statesmanlike role, and that that some of the justices like Amy Coney Barrett are more moderate than we think. And they try to play up a few of the decisions where, you know, concededly the court could have done worse things, but it's really not reflecting what's going on. You know, the thesis that I had in my book that you mentioned at the start about how this is a court that for 50 years has been really expanding the rights of corporations and the rich and the powerful, that's been absolutely going on today. But, you know, people don't like to say that. The media doesn't like to say that. There's also another factor, which is that people who cover the court are often very deferential to the justices. So you don't see a lot of people who are, you know, covering the court on a daily basis saying that Breyer should step down, because, you know, they want to be on good terms with the justices, who are often very good sources. So I think that we get a kind of kid glove approach to the court very often, and not enough people really calling out like, hey, this court is taking away your rights as a voter. It's stopping Black people from voting. It's going to make it really hard to trace dark money in politics. Like, these are very bad things. They're very radical things. And, you know, people should be, you know, banging the table a little bit more, I think.
I'm sorry, Adam, the muffling is pretty bad. Oh. And I just want to make sure that I just want to acknowledge that, because I know that listeners write in and say we're having a hard time hearing. Are you on an iPhone or?
I am, yes. And I'm going to try to talk sort of more carefully.
Is it possible you can switch over to a computer and join us on Zoom?
I can try that. Yeah.
Okay. Why don't we do that? And in the meantime, I've got a lot of notes here from your piece, and I'll just read a little bit.
Okay,
so why don't you try that? Okay. Thank you so much. So we're talking today with Adam Cohen, and I know that we get calls whenever we have bad lines, or emails from listeners when we have bad lines, and I just want to respect that and try to get him on a better line. A couple interesting things that Adam Cohen writes about Justice Breyer in his Atlantic piece. He writes that Breyer's decision about whether to retire this year could be the most consequential of his career. If he remains on the court and is succeeded by a Republican, he could help ensure that the conservative majority stays in place for decades. And that could make Americans more likely to lose abortion rights, employment rights, and even, it is no exaggeration to say, their democracy. He also writes that on some issues, Justice Breyer has disappointed liberal court watchers. In a landmark case, he gave conservatives the fifth vote they needed to hold that the police have broad powers to take DNA samples from criminal suspects. And when the court upheld the Affordable Care Act in 2012, Breyer joined Chief Justice John Roberts in striking down the Act's Medicaid expansion provision on flimsy legal grounds. That part of the decision ended up depriving millions of low-income people of health care. So, of course, you know, the media will say this justice is liberal, this one is conservative, and sometimes they cross lines or they surprise people. That's just obviously how the court works. But Adam Cohen's argument is that if Justice Breyer does not retire, a Republican might replace him with another Republican, and that's exactly what happened with Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So it's a conversation that obviously Justice Breyer should make up his own mind, but it's a conversation that really needs to be had, because these issues are so important. And I believe we have Adam back. Are you there, Adam?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I think so. We'll test it.
Okay.
If you can talk a little bit louder.
Okay, I'll try that.
Okay, that's great. I think the muffling will be gone. So there were a number of really important cases here, and the voting rights case got a lot of attention. We're going to go into that in a little while. What really stood out for you, given that you look at how the cases affect the very wealthy and then everyone else?
Well, you definitely called it right with the voting rights case. Very important, and they've done terrible things with voting. They're going to continue to. And voting is, of course, so important because it's how regular people, it's how poor people, working class people, you know, get their will expressed through the political system. If they're stopped from voting, that empowers the wealthy. Another case like that was one out of California where the court just said that it was not acceptable to require donors to be revealed to charities. And that was not itself a political case, but everyone does suspect the court is going to use that reasoning to make it easier for dark money to continue to permeate our political system. So very threatening decision. And then another California case.
Actually, Adam, can we just spend a little more time on this one? Because I think it's important.
Sure. Sure.
So I just want to read from Vice, a piece called "The Supreme Court Just Made Citizens United Even Worse." In its infamous decision in Citizens United versus FEC, the Supreme Court tossed a bone to lawmakers seeking to regulate money in politics. Now they've stripped most of the lingering meat off that bone. On Thursday, the court handed a 6-3 decision in Americans for Prosperity Foundation versus Bonta, which flips Citizens United's approach to disclosure laws on its head. And so they're arguing that before Thursday, the court treated most disclosure laws as valid, and it typically only allowed plaintiffs who objected to such a law to seek exemption from it. After Americans for Prosperity, there is now a presumption that all such laws are unconstitutional. So tell us what this means exactly. This Americans Prosperity was brought by two conservative organizations, the foundation, which is closely associated with the billionaire Koch brothers, and the Thomas More Law Center, a conservative law firm.
Yeah, you know, disclosure is such a key thing, right? Because as you know, in Citizens United, the court has already opened the floodgates to tremendous amounts of money, not just from wealthy individuals, but from corporate treasuries. And corporate treasuries are, of course, so large. I mean, Jeff Bezos has a lot of money, but Amazon has so much more. So when Citizens United said that corporations could make contributions, that just took things to another level. Now we have this question of disclosure. At least under the Citizens United framework, yes, it would be possible to find out, was Amazon giving all this money? Was, you know, some, you know, terrible foundation giving all this money? Were terrible, you know, rich people with, you know, bad agendas giving all this money? Once you begin to say that disclosure is not legal, requirements of disclosure, then yes, this kind of dark money can permeate our political process and we won't even know it's there. We're just going to be inundated by, you know, vicious attack ads for, you know, one side. We're not going to know who's funding them. And they absolutely have a huge impact on elections. And this translates directly into policy, right? Because political scientists have done a lot of studies showing that it's very hard for voters to get their views expressed in legislation. The degree to which Congress and legislatures follow contributors is just shocking. So take something like the minimum wage, which the federal minimum wage has not been raised since 2009. Every time there's a poll, regular Americans, the majority of Americans, overwhelmingly say they'd like the minimum wage raised. When it's on the ballot in referendums, people overwhelmingly vote to raise the minimum wage. Why is Congress not raising the minimum wage? Because of the retail industry, the fast food industry. They're all giving money, and those are the people that members of Congress actually listen to. So when you allow the extra step of hiding that money so we can't even call it out, it's a very dark moment for democracy.
Well, that one is a really important decision, especially here in California, where we have so many propositions on the ballot and we're bombarded with materials. You know, some props bring in hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yes, and imagine not knowing where that money is coming from and not being able to call it out. I mean, and then, of course, more of these corporations will give more of that money when they can do it secretly, because we're beginning to see some pushback, right? Like, people are pushing back against some of the corporations that have been giving money to Republican members of Congress who supported the insurrection, right? So, and you know, corporations like Toyota are feeling the heat. Well, imagine if Toyota can give that money secretly.
It's just going to be much harder to hold anyone accountable, and will absolutely translate into corporations doing better in Congress and poor working class people doing worse.
Right. What are some other business cases that came down? The Constitutional Accountability Center says that since Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Samuel Alito joined the court in the 2005 term, the court has become increasingly friendly toward big business, often elevating the interests of corporations over those of individuals and ruling for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's position 70% of the time.
Absolutely true. And those numbers are shocking. And, you know, at the beginning, I mentioned how there once was another time under the Warren Court when the court was actually very skeptical of corporations. Well, we're in a very different era now. And, you asked about current cases. Well, the one that I think is just particularly tragic is another California case, the Cedar Point case about union access to organized farm workers. And here's a case where there was a California regulation that said that unions were allowed onto farmland to speak to the workers and try to organize them into a union. That's incredibly important. A lot of people don't understand how it's just so hard to reach workers if you can't reach them at the workplace. Workers scatter after they leave the job. They're hard to track down. You need to go into the workplace, tell them about the virtues of a union, and let them make their own decision. So, of course, employers don't like this, and they challenged the California rule, and the court, came up with a crazy doctrine. They said that it was a taking under the Constitution's takings clause to allow union organizers to go onto farmland and organize the workers. Well, it isn't a taking, because the truth is we have requirements that employers allow all kinds of people into the workplace. OSHA is allowed to go in there to do health and safety inspections. Food inspectors are allowed in. Although Justice Breyer mentioned in his dissent that now all of those things are in danger as well. But anyway, this has an enormous impact because political scientists have shown that one of the most important factors in whether workers are able to earn a decent wage, they can support themselves and their families on, is whether there's a union. Union membership has declined tremendously since the end of World War II. And a lot of that is because the law has been, shaken out from underneath them. And the Supreme Court has done a lot of that. There was another case in the 90s that made it harder for unions literally to be in touch with workers and make their pitch to them. So for the court to do this, and I would also underscore that we all remember that when Chief Justice Roberts was up for confirmation, he said that he thought that the role of the justice was to be an umpire, to call balls and strikes, not to be activists. Well, here's a case where California elected officials made a decision to have this regulation that allowed access to the workers, and the Supreme Court, in this incredibly activist way, struck down that law that was created by the Democratic branches, invoked a constitutional a clause that really doesn't apply, doing all the things that they used to accuse, quote, activist liberal justices of doing. So it was an egregious ruling. The court went out of its way really to make the workplace much more hostile for poor farm workers, and it's a terrible thing.
We talked about farm workers on yesterday's show and just how difficult it has been to deal with this extreme heat wave. And unfortunately, another one is about to hit California in the coming days. And you can find that show at yourcallradio.org. Before we go to break, I also want to ask you about one important regulation case coming up in the next term. The New York Times reports that the court has agreed to hear a case that touches on a legal principle known as Chevron deference, which essentially gives government regulators flexibility to interpret federal law. If the court overturns Chevron deference, it would be a very big deal, limiting the Biden administration's ability to regulate corporations, including its ability to regulate pollution and fight the climate crisis.
All true. And I wrote another book called Nothing to Fear about the start of the New Deal under FDR. And what we saw at the beginning of the New Deal was the creation of the regulatory state. It was amazing when FDR took office how little federal government there was. And in the decades since, this whole regulatory state has come into power. And it's been important because if you want to do things like regulate the environment and make sure that water and air are clean, if you want to make sure that cars and trucks are safe, things like that, you need administrative agencies to do it. This is complicated stuff. Agencies can weigh all the factors and issue rules and regulations. That's how we get government and rules that keep us all safe. And, you know, and that's what they're at war on. If they begin to say that we're not going to defer to administrative agencies are essentially powerless, then there's going to be no way for the federal government to do this type of regulation. The only people that can do the regulation are administrative agencies. So I've said before that I think the ultimate goal of this court is to declare war, not just on the reforms of the 60s, but the reforms of the 1930s that created the New Deal and the administrative state. This case next term, which takes on administrative deference, it sounds so technical and wonky that a lot of us won't be able to follow it closely, but the stakes are very high for having the kind of government that takes care of us that, you know, most of us think is important.
We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're joined by Adam Cohen, author of Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-year battle for a more unjust America. Today, we are talking about the conservative majority on the Supreme Court, 6-3, the term this time around, and then what's coming next term. Coming up after a break, we will talk about the court's decision on voting restrictions in Arizona. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll talk about the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan and the future of the country as the Taliban is expanding its sphere of influence. We'll talk about how the media are looking back at the legacy of the U.S. invasion. And then we will discuss the legacy of Donald Rumsfeld and his pivotal role in the invasion and occupation of Iraq. We hope you can join us tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. If you'd like to join today's conversation about the Supreme Court, if anything stood out for you this term, what are your thoughts about Justice Breyer and what's next? Really important cases coming up next term. We talked about the regulation case. There's also a case on abortion, so important, guns and affirmative action. And now we're going to talk about the major 6-3 decision on voting restrictions in Arizona. And we are still joined by Adam Cohen, who is author of Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-year battle for a more unjust America. We'd also like to welcome Allison Riggs to the show. Allison leads the voting rights program at the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, a nonprofit dedicated to protecting the rights of people of color. In 2018, Allison Riggs argued the Texas redistricting case in the U.S. Supreme Court. In 2019, she argued the North Carolina partisan gerrymandering case in the Supreme Court. Hi, Allison. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. So at issue in this case were two Arizona laws, and let's go over each of them. One banned the collection of absentee ballots by anyone other than a relative or a caregiver. Now, this one is so, so important, especially for people who live on Indian reservations.
That's right. And we submitted an amicus brief, as did many American Indian, Native American groups across the country, explaining that for voters who, one, live in very isolated rural areas, who suffer from socioeconomic disparities resulting from a history of racial discrimination in this country, and who have a distrust and inability to adequately utilize the U.S. Postal Service, ballot collection processes are critically important to making sure that those voters' voices are heard. And we see that in Native and Indigenous communities in Arizona and across the country.
So this one bans the collection of absentee ballots. So, for example, if I live on a reservation and I'm a young person doing activism, I might, you know, drive 2 to 3 hours to pick up ballots for my elders who cannot get to a polling place. So now that is no longer allowed?
That's correct. And there would have been a number of ways in which the state's purported interest in preventing fraud could have been addressed without an outright ban. But what this means is it's going to be there's going to be a greater burden on the individual voter, and that individual voter will have less assistance in making sure that they can cast their ballot. And we think that the litigants in that case proved to the Ninth Circuit and proved in the record evidence that an outright ban violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act.
The other restriction in Arizona throughout any – so basically this one says it throws out any ballots cast in the wrong precinct. So if I go – if I'm – let's say I'm visiting my mom and she's not feeling well and I pass – I give my ballot to her precinct, that means that my ballot will now be thrown out?
That's correct. And the way we see it, and I've litigated cases about out-of-precinct voting, particularly in places where transportation is hard, where people work in flexible job hours. Voters sometimes go to the nearest precinct they can find, and they may work in an area of the city that's not where they're registered to vote, but that's when and how they can vote. And those ballots just get tossed aside, thrown out from votes cast by eligible voters. And that's, again, a mechanism that's a voting and a prohibition on that mechanism that seem facially neutral, but we know absolutely from numerous studies and lived experiences that these kinds of prohibitions and burdens fall disproportionately heavily on communities of color.
So talk about how significant this ruling is, that these two voter repression tactics can stand.
It's deeply troubling. Of course, it is, as any decision, it's based on the facts of the case in Arizona, which means that it's not a per se approval of those kinds of voter suppression measures in other states. But the majority opinion was, to me, represented an extreme interpretation of the plain language of Section 2. Certainly, I think, was intended to and will have the effect of narrowing the usefulness of Section 2 in fighting voter suppression efforts. Those kinds of cases won't become unwinnable, but they'll become much harder. And so it was a disappointing outcome.
What strikes you about the opinions made by the conservative justices? Justice Samuel Alito wrote the decision for the court's majority, and Rick Hassan, a professor of law and political science at UC Irvine, just tweeted that he's reading the opinion. He said it's a horrible, disingenuous opinion. He said, "I'm so angry about this." So what really strikes you about what Justice Alito wrote?
Well, it was surprising to me from justices who claim to want to hew closely to a very literal reading of statutory text from Congress, because the court, in the majority opinion, added in a whole bunch of conditions to the plain language of Section 2 that are not there in the text. So there's no need to go beyond what Congress says it meant. And that's sort of ideologically inconsistent from what we see from these justices. But there were also just some things that were real head scratchers to me. Like, for example, Justice Alito talks about, well, when the Voting Rights Act was enacted was reauthorized and amended in 82, everyone voted in their precinct anyway. So out of precinct provisional voting wasn't anything that Congress even could have contemplated. And I just, that's a really strange stretch. And I don't think that makes a whole lot of sense. I mean, I didn't have a computer in 1982. A lot of election administration has radically changed since then. And the idea that there can't be burdens imposed on voting because those, you know, burdens couldn't have been contemplated in 1982 is explicitly what the Voting Rights Act was, I mean, the Voting Rights Act explicitly was intended to get at future generations of Jim Crow laws and voter suppression, facially neutral laws that had a disproportionate effect on voters of color and kept them from achieving equity in political processes. So it's a strange conclusion.
Adam, what do you think this means for other states that are in the process of passing voter suppression laws? According to the Brennan Center, at least 880 bills have been introduced by Republicans in 49 states that would make it harder to vote. Latosha Brown, just last night, co-founder of Black Voters Matter, tweeted, "The Texas governor called a special session to push a voter suppression bill plus 10 other anti-people Republican bills." She writes, "We're at the Texas State House actually tomorrow, today at noon, in protest of a regressive and racist agenda." So what message does this send to Republicans in other states that are in the process of passing these kinds of bills?
The message it sends is an absolute green light. And, you know, it's the second green light the court has given, because a few years back in a case called Shelby County, the Supreme Court struck down the heart of the Voting Rights Act, the pre-clearance requirement, as it's called, which required localities, before they changed election rules, to get clearance from the Justice Department or a federal court to show that the changes were not going to disadvantage minority voters. That the Supreme Court has already wiped out. Now they're wiping out the other main rubric that can be used to challenge these laws. So absolutely, it's going to tell Texas and other states to go right ahead, pass laws that make it harder for minorities and working people to vote. And beyond that, you know, one thing to really underscore about this decision, like almost every voting case, this was a 6-3 ruling that fell down exactly on ideological grounds. The court has been doing this since Bush versus Gore. It's always the conservatives against the liberals, because, you know, I hate to say it, but what the court is looking at is the outcome. The court in every election case, almost without exception, rules in a way that makes it more likely that Republicans will win elections. They've done it again. So absolutely, any state that has Republican legislatures and governors is being told by the Supreme Court, you know, it's open season, pass those laws.
Allison, what would you add?
I think it certainly tells me that Congress needs to act, that we need to see movement on the John Lewis Act to restore Section 5, that Congress should consider reaffirming its original intent with Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. I do think that we are about to engage in a new level of wars of attrition in certain states with legislatures that are hostile to expansive voting rights. And it continues to be the case that without federal intervention, all we can do is fight those battles one by one, and it's hard.
Right. Well, Allison, before we let you go, as leader of the voting rights program at the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, what is your strategy from here on out, given that so many voting restriction laws have been introduced and will continue to be introduced in the months to come?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the things that we will be looking at is, yes, it's going to be harder to use Section 2 to fight voter suppression, but we'll continue to work to build good records, and we'll continue taking legitimate cases and seeking relief from the federal courts, regardless of, you know, how the hostility we may face, until they slam the doors of the courtroom shut to us. We will continue on behalf of our clients to seek the federal relief that they are guaranteed. We'll build better cases. We'll fight tooth and nail, and we'll think about other legal strategies to ensure that voters of color aren't excluded from the political process.
Well, Allison, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your work.
No, thank you for having me.
Allison Riggs leads the Voting Rights Program at the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, a nonprofit dedicated to protecting the rights of people of color. And we were just talking about the case coming out of Arizona. Adam Cohen is author of Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-Year Battle for a More Unjust America. And Adam writes that over the last 50 years, the Supreme Court has been on a drive to expand the rights of corporations and take away rights from workers, citizens, people of color, and other disadvantaged groups. If you have any questions or comments about the Supreme Court this term, the cases that are coming up, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Adam, what about cases relating to religion? I was really struck under COVID when Amy Coney Barrett, I believe she was the deciding vote to allow churches to remain open under the pandemic, which was, you know, a lot of people, we know a lot of people got sick in churches. I mean, my cousin sadly passed away because she went to a church in Arizona that did not require masks, and she was there for an entire month. So what are your thoughts about cases connected to religion? Because that was one major concern of progressives when she was nominated.
Sure. First, I'm very sorry about your cousin. It's a terrible thing. Well, yes, I think what we're seeing is that, you know, the conservatives have an agenda here around religion, which is to elevate religion. And when states engaged in what was absolutely very reasonable safety regulations around protecting us all from the pandemic, the court tended to view it in terms of, well, this isn't going to interfere with churches, is it? And it's not just in the pandemic context, right? There was actually a ruling this term weeks ago, in an adoption case out of Philadelphia, where the Supreme Court sided with the Catholic adoption agency that refused to work with LGBT families. And there, too, it's because the conservatives on the court have this real desire to protect religion, even when it's putting people's lives in danger, as with the pandemic, even when these religious organizations are engaging in discrimination against protected classes like LGBT folks. And, you know, what we're seeing is this court, you know, plays favorites. Its favorites are not voters. We can see that because it's running rampant over voters. Its favorites are not poor people. It's not unions, because the court has found, you know, a way in the case we just discussed to say that unions don't have a right to go onto people's property and organize workers, even when there's a regulation in place. So those aren't the things the court cares about. The court does care about religion, and if religious entities are acting, this court is going to give them much more leeway to put us all in danger and to discriminate.
You know, it was interesting about the case involving LGBT foster parents is we continue to hear that the justices said that LGBT parents can go to other agencies. And NPR had a really good interview with Rob and Reese Shear, who adopted 5 children out of the foster system. And they said, it's not about going to another agency. It's about ensuring that these agencies open their doors to everyone, regardless of whether or not they're LGBT.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And think of the badge of inferiority that the court is putting on LGBT families when they say, oh, yeah, we're going to allow some people to discriminate against you as long as there are places you can go that don't discriminate. Suppose the court had said that in the 1960s to Black families who say, you know, we're suing because this restaurant isn't serving Black people. And the court says, well, it's true that they're not, but we found some other restaurants you can go to. That's not the American way. The American way is to ensure that people are treated with dignity everywhere. And the court didn't do that. The court said it's enough if you're treated with dignity somewhere.
And this one was a 6-3?
Yes. And, you know, there's a lot of tea leaf reading by all the court followers about why did the liberals go along with it. And I think the consensus is that they did it because they got a more moderate ruling than they otherwise might have. So this was a ruling that didn't go out of its way to say, you know, that we don't care at all about the discrimination. But, you know, we've seen that before. And, I wrote in my book about, you know, my frustration that Justices Breyer and Kagan signed on in the famous big case that upheld Obamacare, which was a great thing. It also struck down Medicaid expansion, which was a requirement that millions of poor people around the country get health care. Well, why did Kagan and Breyer sign off on that? Probably in a deal with the Chief Justice to make sure that the main Obamacare law was upheld. But so the court, you know, the court does this, justices, individual justices do this. So it looks like a compromise, but it certainly doesn't feel good that this was a unanimous decision.
Right. Well, again, I really recommend listening to this interview with Rob and Reese Scheer. They sound like amazing people, and they made some really interesting and powerful arguments in this NPR interview. Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Well, I mean, if I wasn't depressed before I started listening to the program, I am now. I guess the thing that I'm concerned about, and I don't have anything very enlightening to add to this, is one, you look at the court and you look at what's happening with the climate crisis and the fact that the country isn't moving in a direction that's going to be sane or humane for most people. I don't know what kind of strategy can be employed at this point by people on the left or progressive or whatever you want to call them to try and deal with this, because clearly the country isn't dealing with the environmental issue the way it should be. And you can see from this program what you're talking about, where we are with the Supreme Court, what's going on with the states. And I'd say I'm pretty pessimistic about where things are headed. I'm glad that your female guest said we're going to fight this, you know, tooth and nail in court. And yet I'm wondering what other strategies are available to people on the left who want to try and preserve what's left, if there is any democracy in this country. So I know this is a little bit off your topic, but this is really making me feel like it's going to be a dark, dark period, especially if the Democrats lose in 2022 and 2024.
Thank you, Greg. It's such an important question. Adam, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think Greg raises great points and points that we're all kind of worried about. So I would say a couple of things. One is, at least we're getting some truth from the court, right? I think for a long time, people were under the misapprehension that the court actually battled for the disadvantaged in our society, kind of a throwback to Brown versus Board of Education. People thought, oh, the Supreme Court is on the side of the little guy. I think now a lot of Americans are waking up and realizing, no, the Supreme Court has long been on the side of rich and powerful. Let's just call it what it is. So a couple of things. One is, it does mean we need to do the fight in the political sphere, and that's for president, elections for Congress, but also local state elections, very, very important. And the other thing is, I think we do need to talk more about expanding the court, term limits, things like that. They keep pressure on the court. You know, FDR was in a similar situation at the start of the New Deal when the Supreme Court kept striking down the major laws of the New Deal that were designed to save, you know, a country with 25% unemployment and huge poverty. FDR finally talked about packing the court, and lo and behold, the court that had been striking down all these laws stopped doing that. So I think that if we call out the court, say that what it's doing is not in keeping with the majority views of the American public, that if we need to, we'll expand the court or put in term limits, maybe that pushback will at least have some effect. But I agree, we're not in a great place right now.
Yeah, well, thank you for calling, Greg. I'm sorry we're depressing you. We feel your pain, but it's so important to shine a light on these issues and really be honest about them and about where we are right now, and to continue talking about what it will take to change things. We have a related email from a listener who says, isn't the Supreme Court supposed to be in the service of the people? Or this listener writes, is the Supreme Court supposed to be in service of the people or in service of the government? As a citizen, voter, and person of color, it is felt as if the court is not in service to the people. In many ways, they seem far removed from what is happening on the ground.
I think it's a great point, and it goes back to what I was saying a moment ago, that I think we've been led to believe that the court is on the side of the little people, but it just isn't. And throughout history, think about it. What was the court doing before the Civil War? It was upholding slavery. We've all read Dred Scott in high school. Well, they upheld slavery. What did it do after the Civil War? It upheld racial segregation in Plessy versus Ferguson. What did it do during the Progressive Era? It kept striking down laws against child labor, and it struck down laws, minimum wages and maximum hours for workers. So this is what the court has always been, and we need to sort of realize that the court is not our friend, and we're going to look for other friends.
Well, the next term is going to be huge because we have an abortion case coming up. The conservative majority will hear Mississippi's bid to revive a Republican-backed law that bans abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy. This could drastically undercut Roe v. Wade. The justices also agreed to take up a challenge backed by the NRA to New York State's restrictions on people carrying concealed handguns in public. That's another huge case. And then there's a big Harvard affirmative action case. So we're going to get at least three major, major decisions in the next term.
Yes, quite likely, and quite disturbing. As you say, Roe v. Wade could very well be overturned in a year under this Mississippi law, and that will mean that women in places like Mississippi and Alabama won't have abortion rights, and that, you know, we're going to need to find a way to get them to states where they do have abortion rights. We absolutely could have a change in Second Amendment law. And, you know, I'm talking to you now from New York, and like many cities, New York is having a huge spike in shootings. I mean, huge numbers of shootings. And we're all talking about how do we get these shootings under control. If the Supreme Court comes along and says, you know, you've got a right to, you know, brandish your weapons more openly, that will be terrible. And then the affirmative action case out of Harvard, huge potential to do major damage. This court is quite possibly one that's going to say that affirmative action in general is unconstitutional. The Chief Justice has been opposed to any kind of race-based solutions to anything for a very long time. He may have five votes now. So, you know, I think a lot of people think that this term has just been sort of setting the table for the huge, huge seismic shocks that could come in next year.
Well, Adam, we really appreciate your work on all of these issues. Thank you so much for your book, and thank you again for joining us.
Thanks for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you. Adam Cohen is author of a really important book, Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-Year Battle for a More Unjust America. He served as a member of the New York Times editorial board and a senior writer for Time magazine. You can find his latest piece called Justice Breyer's Legacy-Defining Decision. The longer Breyer remains, the more likely a Republican president choosing his successor becomes. That is at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Joanne Marr for engineering our show. Coming up tomorrow, we'll discuss the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. How are the media looking back at the legacy of the U.S. invasion? Later in the show, we'll discuss the legacy of Donald Rumsfeld, who recently passed, and his pivotal role in the invasion and occupation of Iraq. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks so much for joining us.